And welcome back to Coast. This is the hour. We're going to take your calls with Mark Carlotto and chat more about his work, Not of This World. So get ready. Welcome back. Mark Carlotto with us, his book, Not of This World. Mark, you spent some time talking about crop circles and crop formations. Tell me about that.
Well, I've kind of, in a prior life, I also spent a little time looking at crop circle phenomenon, lights and related phenomenon. And there was a video that I remember first seeing back in the 90s of a place called Oliver's Castle. And the claim was that this video shows lights creating a UFO. And of course, it was dismissed at the time as a fake. I analyze it in the book in a slightly different way, and I think it provides some pretty compelling evidence that, at least in that case, lights flying around appear to induce the formation of a crop circle. There was another case, Milk Hill, that shows lights moving in a wave that seems to be interacting with crop, you know, with the crop fields and with tractor driver. And so, you know, it's, again, I think it's, you know, I think all these things are related. It's one equation, if you will. Everything's got to add up. And I think it sort of provides a different dimension on the phenomenon. Again, I think it suggests that this is not an extraterrestrial phenomenon because, you know, Seth Shostak talks about how, why would anyone come all this distance just to write on our fields? Why not just talk to us? But if it's something else, if it's some sort of Earth phenomenon, then perhaps, you know, that might make sense.
I've always thought it could be the planet itself trying to communicate with us.
Right. Well, what does that mean? I mean, is that, you know, I think you're right. And I think, you know, to me, that means the consciousness of the planet and all of us.
Exactly. And it's a living organism. It's there. And it's, you know, it can't speak to us, so it does it this way.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, back to your original book that we were talking about back in September, about the Before Atlantis. Have you tied in any possibilities that Atlantis may have been extraterrestrial related, or is it the other way around?
Well, so in Before Atlantis, I purposely avoided the ancient aliens hypothesis, you know, because that's so prevalent, right? I always feel like saying that something is alien in nature is almost like invoking they used to call it the Deus Ex Machina, you know, the gods would come and save the day. And so it doesn't leave a whole lot of room for science. So in Before Atlantis, I sort of put that aside and said, let's look at prior civilizations, prior subspecies that we know, you know, have evolved and died off, like Denisovans and Neanderthals, and discovering more and more of them. And perhaps they had something to do. Perhaps they did reach a level of technological sophistication that was lost through, you know, through climate change catastrophes that we don't have much evidence of. You know, they say that, you know, a lot, you know, the really interesting stuff is buried deep and it's hard to get at. So, you know, we may never detect, or it may take us a very long time to find evidence. There are selected, you know, so-called out-of-place artifacts that they found in the fossil record. Corliss in his books talks has a number of anomalies, but again they're sort of, you know, dismissed. But that whole hypothesis is kind of like an alternative take. Let's not look at the extraterrestrials. Let's say maybe this developed entirely on Earth over a very long period of time, which leads to some interesting possibilities.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And do you think, talking about disclosure, we're going to get any information from the government this month?
I don't think so. I really don't think they know what's going on. You know, of course, it's not cool to say that because, you know, you want to look to your government to have all the answers.
Right. You would hope so.
Yeah. But, you know, there's clearly a lot of stuff in life that we don't know. You know, we we know how to do, you know, we know how to get to the moon and probably get to Mars, and we know how to make cell phones and internets and things like that, but it's probably much more, you know, to the universe is, you know, a whole mystery of consciousness and, you know, related fields of, related fields of study, and spiritual experiences. I think this is a whole other dimension, literally, that is not very well understood. That, you know, I think the answer lies there. I don't think we're going to get much from the government. I don't think they're going to say, yeah, we have evidence that this is all Soviet or Chinese technology, or, because I don't think they know, I think that's the state of things right now. And I think, again, that's not a cool thing for a government to say, I don't know, but they've got to do that in a as skillful a way as possible, so that people don't get alarmed. And I think the way they do that is by saying, hey, you know, it's not extraterrestrial. It's not, you know, they sort of dismiss it and they sort of tongue in cheek.
Absolutely.
But it's serious. I think it's serious. I think this is the most important phenomenon of our time.
Oh, it's earth shattering, literally. I mean, to think about the possibility of extraterrestrial life out there that's been visiting us since the beginning of time, we may have been seeded by them. Who knows?
I know, after seeing Star Wars, though, I don't think I want to call it earth shattering.
Huh? No, not really. Or Independence Day. Let's go to Mark in Baltimore. Welcome to the program, East of the Rockies. Hey, Mark.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my telephone
Thank you,
call.
Mark. Thank you.
So I've been looking at some of the images from the Mars high-rise orbiter. That's that high-resolution orbiter, and I'm old enough to remember when that very first picture of the face on Mars came out, and, you know, they tried to bury that, and then it surfaced, and there were books written about it, and at first people laughed and said, that's nothing. Even National Geographic in their Millennium issue, they had a photograph of it, and they took it from a bad angle. It was from the Global Observer, and they just printed one from a bad angle and called it a rocky mesa. And, you know, anybody can go, if they look at the images from the Mars high-rise orbiter, you know, the people that control that orbiter, you know, they were nice enough, I guess, for us. You know, they were smart enough to say, hey, let's go and take a closer look at that thing. And, you know, I've looked at those images, and I've got to say, there's no doubt in my mind that that's a face on Mars. What are your thoughts on that, if you don't mind me asking?
Hey, Mark. Thanks for calling in. You know, I agree. I think we're looking at something that's extremely old. It's highly eroded. You know, Mars is not like the moon. Things on the moon aren't really disturbed. Of course, they're covered over with dust over a period of time, but
right. There's
no, you know, there's no erosional processes on the moon. There's no winds and there's no weather. But on Mars, there is all of the above. And I think, you know, an ancient formation that was artificially constructed over time would degrade. I mean, you see this in Egypt. In Egypt, there are pyramids that are indistinguishable from rock formations. So, you know, I think it's there's a very good chance that it's artificial. I'm hoping that, you know, we're talking about sending probes to Venus and, you know, flying helicopters around on Mars. But I think there's some really interesting scientific questions that need to be addressed. I think this is one of them. I also think they should be, you know, like going underground in caves. I mean, I don't really believe that there's a high likelihood of finding anything on the surface of Mars. And so, you know, I think going into caves, exploring underground, is something that should be doing, as well as mounting an expedition, hopefully, when human explorers get there in a few years, 10 years, maybe, hopefully less, Cydonia will be one of their targets. I mean, we've got to go there. To not go there would be
a tragedy.
Terrible.
Yeah, it would be. And, you know, with Mars, something horrible happened environmentally to that planet a long time ago, don't you think?
Yeah, my friend and colleague John Brandenburg has written about that extensively. Yeah. He believes it was a nuclear event on Mars.
The entire planet was engulfed in it, probably.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but as remarkable as that sounds, even, you know, the planetary science community admits that, you know, Mars did, you know, it did lose its atmosphere, maybe not catastrophically in that way, but it did lose its atmosphere and its biosphere early on. And they don't believe for that reason that, you know, an indigenous, indigenous life and a technological civilization could have developed on Mars, you know, or anything capable of having created the face. And of course, they don't believe in UFOs and aliens, so that can't be that can't be an explanation. So if it's not a rock formation, then that means that we put it there, which goes back to your question.
Which is possible. Yeah, which is possible.
I think so.
But do you think a planetary-wide disaster could have occurred after the planet was inhabited and it just wiped out everybody, or they took off and, you know, got in craft and escaped and maybe came to planet Earth? Who knows?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's possible. That's kind of not as much in my wheelhouse. I'm speculating as much as anyone else on that. It's possible. It's interesting. NASA, in their sort of like retooling their SETI program and starting to look for something called technosignatures within our solar system. And they're actually talking, I don't know how seriously they are about this, but, you know, talking about possibly trying to find evidence of prior civilization, earlier civilizations on Earth and on Mars and Venus. So if you take them at their word and they're going to develop some technologies, maybe we're talking about some advanced satellite-based radars that could, like, look, you know, through the soil. Like years ago, they were flying these radars I think they were shuttle imaging radars that were imaging like these old river valleys in Egypt. And so, you know, they might be able to employ similar technologies on Mars to find things that are buried beneath the sand.
Let's go to John in Broomfield, Colorado, west of the Rockies. John, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm glad to be speaking to you tonight. Take on the UFOs is that I've been looking at Europa for quite a while. I've had a big interest because my daughter, who's a world-class spectroscopist, discovered early on in her career, they were given an exercise to look at data from Mauna Kea of Europa, and they found that the water on Europa was that they were looking at on the surface was 60% heavy water.
Mm-hmm.
It's got deuterium oxide in it. And Europa is a good candidate for life because there's more, the ocean is bigger than the ocean on the Earth. And there's underground volcanoes and so forth where there's life could have formed, and it's been there for many, many years, and it's become quite intelligent. They thought that there was surface of Europa was covered by kilometer-sized or thick, maybe 20 kilometers thick layer of ice, but recently the Hubble Space Telescope found geysers at the South Pole of Europa. And I came up with a mechanism for how there could have been on the surface, there could have been deuterium oxide instead of hydrogen oxide water, the heavy water. And that is, by the geysers, the lighter water would escape and the heavy water would come down, fall back down onto the surface. And then it also makes, because there's geysers, it makes it look like it's easier for them to, if there's intelligent life on, smarter than whales and dolphins and so forth, there that they could use the rocket propulsion system that The professor at the University of Reno, Nevada, has come up with that's the deuterium-powered rocket with little tiny explosions in it. And they would be able to carry a water, like, you know, our astronauts fly in an atmosphere of oxygen. They have to carry their own oxygen and that kind of thing. But if they're in a water rocket and they could come down here and visit the Earth and go vacationing in the South Pacific, and they wouldn't be crushed by high accelerations because the water's incompressible and, you know, it's a neutral buoyancy situation. That's how the astronauts train.
And that professor, his last name's Winterberg. That's the guy, isn't it?
That's the guy, yep.
Interesting. What's your take, Mark, on Europa? What do you think?
Yeah, gee, I mean, that you know, I think even, you know, that there's a whole thread there of ideas. You know, probably at the most basic point is, like, can we perform, you know, simple evidence of life tests on Europa like we've been trying to do on Mars? You know, that would be, of course, another really interesting experiment, because then we would have, you know, we have the Earth, we have Mars, we have Europa. I don't know if there's any other candidates in the solar system, just to see kind of, are we finding life anywhere else? You know, what I was talking about with the whole, you know, SETI hypothesis about life being really common in the universe, it's more of a belief, right? It's a starting point for a lot of scientists to assume that, but, you know, we don't really know that for a fact. And we don't even know how life started on Earth. You know, they say, well, okay, it was, you know, perhaps it was panspermia. Well, that begs the question, well, if that's how life got to Earth, how did it start wherever, you know, it came from? And so we just have a lack of basic understanding of the most basic questions in science, like the origin of life. And so I think doing more experiments, I think Europa, that's a really cool idea. I would be very interested to see what they came up with there. And, you know, this whole idea of using native materials for, you know, for propulsion and so forth, that, you know, that we're going to the moon for the helium-3, right? And and SpaceX will be manufacturing methane on Mars. You got to take it with you. You can't bring everything you need. You got to make it from the native materials. So that's kind of a really cool idea on Europa, using exploiting the deuterium.
Mark, do you think the Bible, talking about fallen angels and visitations and things like that, we're talking about ETs, because that's all people, they figured they didn't know about ETs, so they called them angels?
Well, this was what Eric Von Däniken suggested back in the 60s. You know, this is the era of Apollo. We're going into space, and we had just started, I think probably a few years before that, it just started the first SETI search programs with radio telescopes. So, you know, the whole idea was, yeah, there's going to be life out there. It's got to be, it has to be. And so if we can't explain something based on our own human technologies, capabilities, and it's not, you know, and it's not something that's psychic or, you know, non-material, then I think that just naturally led to, well, it must be extraterrestrial.
Exactly. Stay with us, Mark. We're going to come back and take final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back in a moment to take final calls with Mark Carlotto as we talk about Not of This World. Next hour, Robert Wagoner joins us as we talk about lucid dreaming here on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to our final segment with Mark Carlotto, author of Not of This World. Where do people get your book, Mark?
Amazon.
Best place.
Yep.
Quick and efficient and ready to roll.
Yes.
Did you have a difficult time wrestling with yourself on some of the theories in the book?
Not really. I was a little hesitant to write the book to come up with the conclusions that I do at the end, because I realize they really fly in the face of what everyone else thinks. You know, it's kind of, it's different. And so I was like wrestling with how I present that, and, or do I, you know, do I basically not, you know, do I sort of just come up with something that's a little bit more ambiguous, or, you know, just a little softer set of conclusions. And I, in the end, it was like, I just have to sort of do, you know, say what I mean.
Yeah.
And I think it took a little wrestling with that was difficult, because it is, you know, really different from what other books are talking about. There's so much fear. The whole UFO field, people that are involved are, you know, I have a lot of interactions on Facebook with people, and it's just, they're really edgy, and it's just, it's, I don't know. It's really different. But I feel like I need to get a different perspective out. And it took me a little while to figure out how to do that.
Well, people are edgy. I think COVID's had a lot to do with that too, don't you?
It didn't help.
No, not at all. Back to the phones we go. Let's go to Dan in New York on the wild card line. Daniel, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, George.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, the thing here is that I'm an extraterrestrial guy only. I don't believe these ETs are from other dimensions or parallel universe, because these planet worlds in this galaxy, satellite moons and stars of suns, are of many great variety. The numbers of them, the sizes of them, what knocks me over, and the types of them, the various different types of all these. And if you're going to have all of that, you're going to create a great variety of forces, of energies, which creates physics, elements of matter, which creates chemistry. And in return, all that is going to create various amounts of biologies. That's why maybe these ETs can communicate telepathy-wise, and also various types of technologies. So with all these G-forces talking about it, maybe that's why they have a certain technology or certain condition inside their craft that they don't get crushed. And of course, naturally, all the ingredients for life is spread throughout the cosmos. But I'll just stop here. I got the ingredients here, but...
Well, that's well said, though, Dan, because Seth Shostak, Mark, from SETI again, once told me on this program that the primordial soup in the universe is the same everywhere. And so his theory was, of course, that life is abundant out there. What do you think?
Right. And when you look at it from that perspective, I agree. However, you know, the Big Bang is just one theory of the universe. You know, the
whatever that is, by the way.
Whatever that is, the mainstream view is that a singularity, from a singularity came basically every, you know, time and space. And over long periods of time, from matter evolved life. Life suddenly developed. And then from life emerged consciousness, self-awareness, and so forth. But that's not the only theory of creation. You know, the mystics talk about emanations of, you know, of that in the beginning, there wasn't a singularity. In the beginning, there was consciousness, pure consciousness. And the act of creation was the subdivision of that consciousness, was the unfolding of planes of existence, of different, if you want to call them dimensions or planes of consciousness, from pure consciousness to lesser and lesser degrees down to our physical plane, which is mostly, you know, mostly matter and very little consciousness. So if you look at things from that point of view, then sort of you come up with a different take, and that's kind of where I go with the book. But I agree, Dan. If you go with a mainstream theory, then that's basically what, you know, SETI is talking about and where they're going, and that's their hypothesis. But it remains to be seen if it's correct. I mean, it hasn't been proven. It's unproven. There's no data to support it. I mean, I hate to be blunt, but there really is no proof of that there is life out there. I mean, it's speculation, but there's no proof of it.
You've got a doctorate in electrical engineering. Was it difficult for you, Mark, to kind of get into this field of the possibilities of extraterrestrial life?
My life path could be a whole other show, and it's one that no one would be interested in. I think, you know, engineering is a very creative field in general. It's not just making things faster or better or cheaper. There's a lot of creativity, and you sort of learn how to synthesize ideas. And, you know, science is very sort of, you know, it follows a certain pattern, a certain paradigm. And I think engineers have a way of sort of upsetting things. You know, there's the whole concept of disruptive technologies, you know, where you look at things in a completely different way. And I think, you know, that's what I'm trying to do here. I think being an engineer makes me pretty well suited for it.
Let's go to Blair in Sedona, Arizona. Welcome to the program, Blair.
Well, early birthday greetings to you, George.
Thank you, Blair. Pretty soon.
Hey, Dr. Carlotto, will you share your study of the backside of the moon, possibly following up on the NASA Clementine photos, and other countries like China and India making discoveries there similar to the Russian Zond moon mission photos?
Yeah, that's so. This is a little sidetracked. A few years ago, some of my colleagues from back in the Mars days had found some really intriguing photos on the moon. You know, I had spent a little time working with Dick Hoagland way back then. Dick was, you know, had been studying Apollo and lunar orbiter photos, and he believed that there was evidence of structures on the moon. And I never felt that the evidence was strong enough, and I didn't really pursue that at the time. But what some colleagues of mine, Fran Ridge and Ananda Saracena, discovered were there's some Apollo photos that showed some structures on the far side of the moon that were really interesting. And what we've been doing when these things come up, you know, we'll sort of email each other. It's like, well, I found this or found that. It's like, well, let's see if we can find some lunar orbiter, some more recent imagery. And they did, and they found tons of shots over this feature, and we're able to corroborate that it's actually even more interesting in more recent imagery. So, you know, I think, you know, now the Chinese are on the far side as well, and I don't really know what they've been able to find or what their agenda is, but there's certainly some intriguing things. I think probably the most interesting things on the moon might, like on Mars, be underground. If there is anything, Carl Sagan in the 60s talked about the possibility of extraterrestrials being on the backside of the moon, using it as an observation, place for observing the Earth. And it turns out there's some interesting locations near the South Pole, I believe it is, to do so. So people are looking, but I think it's also possible that if there is an ET presence on the moon, it could be, you know, hiding underground. There's been, people have observed these transient lunar events for years, and that could also be correlated with UFOs. So, you know, we're going back to the moon, so it's another one of these things that, you know, we're going to have hardware there and sensors, and it'll be really cool to see what we find. And, you know, we'll be able to continuously monitor some of these areas, and, you know, it'll be really hard for anything transient to escape, our sensors. So I think it'll be some exciting time for some of the science we're talking about here.
Back to the phones we go. Tim in Carson City, Nevada, welcome to the show. Hey, Tim.
Hello, George. It's good to speak with you.
Thank you, sir.
I had the honor of speaking with Art Bell in 1995, and I've been a fan this whole time.
It's a long time. Thank you.
Yeah. So I have a couple of devil's advocate questions to ask you.
Okay.
I'm disabled, and I've been sky watching every night for the last 7 years. And I have seen things that, let's just say mind-blowing things in the sky, day and night. So I know there's something out there. So my devil's advocate is, I kind of lean that what I'm seeing is Earth-based. I think it was Mr. Lear that said there's some stuff out there that's 10 years more advanced than what is known to the public.
And that could be. That could be.
And I believe the head of Skunk Works says 50 years more advanced. So my question is, if civilizations can travel across light years to get all the way here, would they be inept enough to be susceptible to crash? I mean, the technology has got to be way more advanced considering where we are now. And my second point I'd like to hear your comment on is, would civilizations that advanced even need the use of light? I mean, we already have night vision. They must have, like, hypervision.
Well, they'd have to.
I'd like to hear you and your guest comments on that.
I'd always wondered about Roswell. If they had the technology to get here, Mark, how could they crash?
Yeah, you know, so one speculation is that this is part of the, you know, the so-called alien agenda to gradually make their presence known over a period of time and you know, in fits and starts through, you know, limited disclosures or you know, perhaps that was from hardworking crashes or sightings. And I, you know, I don't know. That's certainly possible. I know, you know, I'm trying to think of the gentleman's name who came up with this idea called the embargo hypothesis that we're, you know, really in a long, very long period of disclosure where, you know, they want their presence to become known over a long period of time because they, you know, the belief is that in that way wouldn't pose a shock or wouldn't disrupt our society. And, you know, I mean, it's entirely plausible. But again, you know, I'm kind of going back to, you know, the evidence for extraterrestrials. And, I don't find compelling evidence. I tend to agree that it's I don't know if it's so much necessarily an Earth phenomenon, but it's a phenomenon that exists in a different reality, a different plane of existence. You know, if you have near-death experiences or when you meditate, you talk about journeying into other realms, the astral plane and those planes beyond that. Perhaps, you know, what we're talking about here is, entities from those planes, avatars, watchers, perhaps. These are talked about in, you know, not just the Judeo-Christian traditions, but, you know, the Vedas talk about, you know, avatars. It's possible that that's what we're seeing here. They're interacting with our physical space, but they're beings that exist at a higher level of consciousness in a different dimension, possibly. You know, I talk about it briefly in the book. Maybe it's the fifth dimension that Kaluza-Klein talked about that they introduced in coming up with a general or a unifying theory of gravity and the other forces, the nuclear forces back in the 20s that Einstein was, somewhat involved in. I mention it. I'm not a physicist, but, you know, I think there's a lot of possible connections here. And I think the possibility that this stuff may be related to spiritual experiences is an intriguing possibility to consider.
You can't rule out a lot of stuff, and I think that embargo hypothesis person was Johannes Friedberg.
Oh yeah, Johannes. Yes, I had. Yeah, I actually stayed with him in Germany. He tragically passed away way too young, a number of years ago.
He was
ago.
A genius, wasn't he?
Yeah, really a sweet guy. Yeah, and very very smart and some. Really, really interesting ideas, yes.
Mark, we've got your websites all linked up at coasttocoastam.com, your book, Not of This World, as you mentioned, available on amazon.com. And what's your favorite website that they can track you with?
For this, it's notofthisworldufo.com. Before Atlantis, it's beforeatlantis.com.
Okay, super. Mark, thanks again. Come back again, and always look forward to chatting with you. Up next, Lucid Dreaming on Coast to Coast AM.